Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, members and public. We have, actually, this will be the last opportunity we have for hearing bills before we put our omnibus bill together. So we have a number of bills, and then right at the end, before we are done, there's a couple of additional fund transfers that I'd like to just hand out, and they came in late. So I'd like to hand those out so that members can see those two. First, we'll start out with Senate File 1183, Senator Anderson's bill. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. And we're lucky to have the mayor of St. Paul with us this morning, so we're glad we could fit this into the schedule, and thank you for giving us a hearing on the bill. This bill is something that this committee has discussed a little bit as we've talked about how to improve educational outcomes for our children in our environment where we're constantly struggling for paying for the resources that we have. And what the city of St. Paul has done is looked at ways to maximize the opportunities for educating children outside of the school day and making sure that they have a seamless learning experience before, during, and after school so that we can try to reach the highest standards possible and improve our graduation rate, improve our outcomes in high school so children are going on to post-secondary and good jobs and have a good lifelong education experience. So we're especially concerned about academic achievement of children who might not participate in quality after-school programs, but spend a lot of time in the community after school. And there's an opportunity for us to try to improve their educational experiences. So even though we know that educating children is not a core function or purpose of city services, we have libraries and recreation city services like most cities do that provide programs for recreational and educational opportunities for our children and families. And while we have great city staff who staff our libraries and recreation centers, they're not licensed teachers and they're not child care providers. So because we're already spending as a city so much money to provide services to these children, we thought it made sense to have a greater impact and maximize the learning outcomes of these encounters that children have with libraries and rec centers. And so what we intend to do by this bill is intentionally integrate learning opportunities that support their classroom instruction. And so simply what the bill does is ask for a small appropriation, which will be used specifically to increase professional development opportunities and program support for park and recreation staff and library staff who interact with children. And so what we'll do is teach them, these staff, how to incorporate age-appropriate skill building and intentional learning opportunities into the work that they're already doing to raise it to a higher level and maximize the outcomes that come from those interactions. And we also incorporate in the bill a requirement for an evaluation. So we ask the city to evaluate the success of this increased professional development on the learning outcomes and educational outcomes of our children, and to bring that back to the legislature for us to look at, because we think this could be a model for the state. And so with that, I'd like to introduce the mayor of St. Paul, Chris Coleman, and then we have someone from, let me just introduce the others who are here, and they'd like to just say a couple of words. I know we don't have a lot of time. We have Melanie Huggins from the director of the St. Paul Public Libraries, and Kathy Corum from the St. Paul Parks and Recreation Department, and Valle Varo is the education director from the mayor's office. So, great. Mayor Coleman.
Welcome, Mayor. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Coleman, mayor of the city of St. Paul. And Senator Anderson has done an excellent job of outlining what we are attempting to accomplish in St. Paul. When I was a parent of young children, they're not so young anymore. But we talked about teachable moments, you know, those times where there was a chance to impart a lesson to a child. And I believe that every moment of the day has to be a teachable moment for a child. And we have focused so much on what's happening within the walls of the school district, from 8 to 3 or 9 to 5 or whatever that would be, that we forgot about the fact that in our parks, in our libraries, in community centers, in places and organizations across the city of St. Paul, there are ways that we can extend the learning day that enhance what's happening when they go to school in the morning, helping kids with homework, helping kids with basic lessons, helping them just kind of be productive citizens. It has just become the focus of so much of what our work is. And what we are trying to do is we have restructured our parks and rec centers, how we deliver those services so that we can take advantage of these opportunities to extend the learning day. Our library system is kind of, thinking how they should best deliver services, homework centers and various things. But we do need more training, more education to help enhance that opportunity. I won't go over everything that we have going. I'd like to turn it over to Kathy and to Melanie to tell you more. But at the end of the day, we believe that the way that we are going to help kids overcome the deficits they have right now, overcome the achievement gaps that we have, is to create a learning community in the entire city of St. Paul, and we're doing that. The bill that's before you could really enhance our efforts.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a very progressive vision that you have in terms of young people. I remember listening to President Clinton's State of the State address a number of years ago, and he had a provision in there that I think a lot of people kind of laughed at, but in reality, I think it was a very valuable one, and that is, to keep a number of our facilities like gymnasiums and recreational facilities open until midnight, to allow the young people to use them. The idea was is basically give our young people something to do, have some opportunity so that they're not standing on the street corner and they're not getting into trouble in some way or other. So, yeah, it's great.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I'm sure you are aware of, between 3 and 6 in the afternoon, juvenile crime triples. It is the number one problem that we have is that kids don't have things to do and they don't have productive activity. And so to simply say that, while the schools are failing our children because, from 3 to 6 they're going out and they have nothing to do in their community, it is just very short-sighted to think of education as only what happens in the building and not what happens in the broader community.
Thank you. Did you say... who's going to go next?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have different names than show up on the agenda. So that's, I think Melanie will go next. Melanie
Absolutely.
Huggins is our St. Paul Public Libraries Director.
Thank you. Welcome, and please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Melanie Huggins. I'm the very proud director of the St. Paul Public Library. And I'm just going to take a short minute to just reiterate some of the things, and you'll hear Kathy, my colleague at Parks and Rec, talking about some of the specific training needs that we both face. But we are one urban library that is bucking the trends in the country. We are seeing increases in usage every year, which is really exciting for us. In 2006, in our 13 locations in our bookmobile, we saw over 2.5 million visitors. We circulated, checked out over 3.4 million items. We saw over 70,000 young people come through our doors and organize programs, whether they be story times or Boys and Girls Clubs or Boy Scouts. We've added over 60,000 items for homework support in 2006 alone. So we are growing. Our capacity to do this work is growing in the sense that we're adding resources and people are coming through the doors. What's not growing, and it's almost a little sad for me, is that the staffing level has remained the same since 1992. We have 179 full-time employees. We had 179 full-time employees in 1992. We have 180 full-time employees now. So I celebrate that one. Maybe that's me. I celebrate that one, but also what you need to know about the profession, and you may hear a little cheer from the crowd back here in the corner, is that they are nearing retirement. They are... they are predominantly white women who are nearing retirement. We have not hired a new librarian from outside of the system, except for me, in St. Paul since the 1980s. We are growing our own staff, which is wonderful, giving our clerks a chance to come up and go to library school. But what that tells us is the skills that we have are lacking in the way, and they're not meeting the demands the way people are using the library today. People who went to library school back then, and even me to some degree, we got into it because we love literature, we love the books, we love that piece of our work. Our work has changed dramatically. We are a hub of information for communities and cultures for new immigrants, and we need to be better prepared to do that work, and especially with youth. And this is not rocket science. In 1999 to 2003, the Forum for Youth Investment and the Urban Libraries Council funded a 4-year project in 10 libraries across the country to see if they could come up with some interesting pilot programs of working with youth in new ways. I was fortunate in my former job to be a part of that pilot. The research from that pilot project funded by the Wallace Foundation was that youth need structure. So it's not just about having things to do in that 3 to 6 or 3 to 9. They need quality. Quality matters. And we know from that research what quality looks like. They need a place to belong. They need skills being built. They need a safe haven. They need to incorporate their families into their activities. And I think that parks and libraries are really well positioned to do that. You go to any library or parks after school and they're packed with young people. So we are really excited about this bill. We know that our staff need more skills development. You'll hear some about those specific skills from Kathy. And you hit the nail on the head, Mr. Chair. You can't have prevention without opportunity. And libraries and parks and rec are places where we can provide youth wonderful opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Huggins.
Mr. Chair, next we have Kathy Corum from the St. Paul Parks and Rec Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I share Melanie's passion and will reiterate a couple of points that have already been made.
Before you start, could I ask you to just give your name for
Kathy
the record?
Kathy Corum. I'm actually the manager of recreation services for Parks and Recreation.
Thank you.
With two parents who were school teachers and an undergraduate degree in education myself, I too appreciate the opportunities that are provided for youth during the school day. But the reality is that if you look at after-school time and weekends and holiday breaks and summer vacation, the youth in St. Paul and Minneapolis as well spend more time with our library staff and our parks and recreation staff than they do with school teachers, and in some cases even their own families. The city that I grew up in St. Paul, is very different than the one I work in now, with more than 70% of our young people children of color. And as Melanie mentioned, the demands on our library and parks and recreation staff are very different than the ones in days gone by. Where our librarians helped us find books and our recreation staff helped us get equipment for the games we organized ourselves, a time of paper and pencil, if you will. Today, our professionals are not only doing homework help, providing arts and crafts activities, health, sports, and fitness programs, but they also refer the children and the families to a variety of social services. They work with emerging cultures and new immigrants. We've been asked to respond to activity trends that incorporate technology and extreme sports. We serve summer lunch, and we act as adult mentors to the youth in our communities. We help kids learn to make healthy decisions, build social skills, resiliency skills, and learn to manage their anger effectively. We bring people together through recreational and library programs that would have no other reason to interact otherwise. We build community and give people a sense of place in their neighborhoods. Like the libraries, in 2006, we had nearly 3 million visitors at our 41 recreation centers. And we'd like to see, with training provided for our staff, even more visitors as our sites become more welcoming and inviting. As we speak in general terms about aging infrastructures in urban communities like ours, I point to our staff as well. Skilled and dedicated as they are an aging infrastructure. And we, too, are growing our own staff. While it is not built into a program like it is for school teachers, we've provided intermittent training for our employees along the way. But it's been a challenge. We've done that with other staff. We've done it within the budgets that we currently have. And without assistance from you, we do tend to fall farther behind and will likely do that even more in the future. We're not talking about how to write a business letter or how to run a youth sports tournament. Our staff know how to do that. We're talking about training related to youth development, cultural competency, developing effective community collaborations, facilitating community meetings, public speaking, and integrating appropriate skill building and intentional learning into programs that exist already. We also want to develop learning kits for our families to use at home. And if I were sitting in one of your chairs, I might be asking, why would they want money from the state and not just figure this out as a city? And the reality is that we can't within the budgets that we currently have. Our intent is not to pay a consultant to come in and do some kind of one-time canned type of training, but we'd like to be a model, not only for our colleagues in Minneapolis, but for our colleagues around the state and across the country. St. Paul Parks and Recreation is one of fewer than 80 nationally accredited agencies in our field. And in 2005, we were proud to accept a gold medal award for excellence from the National Recreation and Park Association. We're well respected by our colleagues around the country for providing quality programs, and we're ready to lead the way in the area of staff development training. We'd like to be a model not only for our friends in the state, but across the country as well. And if you'll commit funds to this project, Melanie and I will make a commitment to you that we'd be happy to share these resources and materials with any of our colleagues that ask. And we believe that we truly can be a model. While we're both eager to provide the level of training that this bill supports for our over 350 employees combined, we certainly are eager to assist our colleagues around the state. And we'd love to come back in a couple of years and thank you for helping us do that.
Thank you. Any questions, Senator Bonner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Huggins, what do you attribute the great success in terms of having young people come in the library after school? Do you market to them? Do you have a relationship with the schools? How are you reaching this population?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is a wonderful question. Excuse me. It's a little bit of a combination of things. One of the things we know is that programs don't build youth, but communities do. And libraries are in all of those neighborhoods. So where they may go to a magnet school across town, that library is just a couple blocks from their home. We're open those hours where they're looking for things. We're free. The technology has been a huge draw. We have over 300 computers for public use, and we're going to be wireless in all of our locations. So that's a big draw for teens to come in and young people to come in as well. We have homework centers, dedicated space with volunteers and tutors in 5 of our locations, and we'd like to expand that. I think we can expand the practices of homework centers without having to build new homework centers as well. So some of this training money would be to take those best practices from our library and other cities and expand that. And word of mouth is what we learned through our study with Forum for Youth Investment, is that if teens feel valued and young people see themselves in the library, they tell their friends. And so much of the marketing and promotion just goes from child to child. And we do reach out to the schools, and we have staff that regularly visit schools and say, come see us. We're the face that you'll see when you come into your neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, as a mom, I know the libraries also have these little cards where you can go get a coupon and check it out to go to local attractions like the Children's Museum at a reduced or free rate. And I don't know if other libraries do that, but it's fantastic. We love that.
Yes.
And my neighbors love that. I've heard about that from other parents. Mm-hmm. And Mr. go ahead. I'll see if there's other questions.
I don't see any hands. So.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make just a comment or two in conclusion here. I think just to try to pull this all back together to what the mission of this committee is, the E-12 Education Committee, I think that the links of what St. Paul is doing to what we're doing as a state legislature and as a Senate committee to try to support the best education outcomes we can are... I just really want to emphasize that. We've talked a lot about after-school enrichment in this committee over the years and have been very frustrated as we've lost the funding for that. I know Senator Scheid's trying to bring that back. We know that those after-school enrichment grants help to improve student outcomes in school because they worked directly on truancy and had improvement, you know, lesser rates of truancy and better kids doing their homework. And so there was a direct connection there. We've talked a lot in this committee in the discussion about Senator Clark's bill about the difference between, you know, child care or even just babysitting, that some children sit in a home and they're being babysat, as opposed to actually quality early childhood education opportunities for those children, and that difference is real and it matters, and that with some support we can make that. We can provide those educational opportunities to maximize that time that they spend in their early childhood setting, whatever it is. This is the same idea, to try to maximize those really good educational outcomes in those community settings that children spend a lot of time in. And so I think it's very closely linked to our efforts to improve student achievement across the board.
Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Anderson, along those lines, I have a little amendment for about $10 million. Senator Torres Ray and I may be collaborating here to – I certainly support, you know, what you're doing here. I did want to ask if the people who are working with the programs that you're doing now, where you – how you're getting funding for some of those things you're doing to for the outreach, but also well, the programs you described how you did the outreach, but what is the source now of that? Because there has to be a cost. If I might.
That's a good question, Senator Scheid. I was thinking of the same thing. It would be helpful to kind of know what kinds of resources and where those resources are coming from right now. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the things, obviously, you're well aware of the challenges that cities across the state of Minnesota are facing with limited resources, with cuts to local government aid, and so we have tried to be very creative with our resources. We faced a $16.5 million budget deficit last year, and it, particularly this was true in Parks and Rec because the library had already gone through some of this reorganization about how they would deliver services differently to free up money to do some of the things that we're talking about here. When the director of Parks came to my office to present his plan to reduce the budget to deal with the deficit, it was just, you could feel it strangling the lifeblood out of our Parks and Rec system. You could just, you know, see that we were going down this road where we were not going to deliver the kind of services that we, A, need to, and B, that our community expects. And so I asked them to go back and come up with a plan that delivered better services. Our mantra last year was better service at a better price. And so they reorganized the department that became less about what supporting buildings and more about supporting people. And we were able to save money, but to create programs that we could take out into the community, that we could partner with the libraries on, that we could kind of have an action team if there was a particular neighborhood that was having some problems. We could move a climbing wall out there and maybe potentially bring a bookmobile out there. So, you know, have a positive gathering. So we're trying to do it within the resources that we have. We still face huge budget problems going forward. That's a topic for another committee. But at the same time, you know, we're trying to do more and more with less and less.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I think it's a real testament to the city that they have made this a priority and have found ways to do everything that they can within their existing budgets and with very difficult budget limits.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, what I really appreciate is the fact that the city has involved itself in areas that aren't normally within its jurisdiction, if you will, in terms of governance, and I appreciate that you're collaborating with schools and libraries, I think, is excellent.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid,
Coleman.
I don't quote David Brooks very often, but there was an article that he wrote a couple of weeks ago that just said, you know, politicians will come in and they'll talk about the importance of school, but until we realize that it's what we do in the entire community, then what we do to talk about schools just isn't going to have the impact that it can. And other cities are going out and they're saying, well, let's take over the school district. You know, the mayor of Los Angeles is doing that. Detroit's done that. New York's looking at it or has done that. And I've said, you know, we have a great school system, but they need a strong partner in the city to help them do what they're doing and do it better.
I think Senator Wicker.
Oh, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson and testifiers, plus all the support and the audience. Absolutely support the concepts, the vision you have here, and hopefully there might be some funds available to achieve that. A question on for the future, thinking maybe 10, 15 years beyond. You have schools now that have libraries. Schools have gyms, and schools usually in their mission statement will say they are places for the community, lifelong learning. And do you see any potential partnerships, if not mergers, in the delivery of services if you were going down 10, 15 or more years. And I'm respectful of the turf issues, but also of how, with limited dollars, you might get a greater yield.
Mr. Chair and Senator Uyghur, it's actually already happening. The partnership between Jimmy Lee Rec Center that's being built in Central High School is already there to try to share resources. And my daughter, who's a freshman at Central High, is quite excited about the fact that this new rec center is going to be built across the street from the school. The mistake that we made, however, was that we, not only are we in the process of building Jimmy Lee, which will be a tremendous community asset, but about a mile away from there, we built the new Rondo Library. And that's a tremendous community asset. And I actually would encourage any member of the committee, just if you've got a little extra time, you know, in the after school hours, just the west 2 miles and pop in there and see what's happening. It's truly wonderful. But we have to rethink. We can't build these separate facilities here and there, because what links those two, having a child go in maybe because they want to read a book and then they get engaged in a physical activity, or vice versa, they go in because they want to play basketball and then maybe they slide over to the library, to the homework center. We are really trying to think today about how, as we do facility planning, how we can merge those opportunities instead of viewing them as separate. We have to be more collaborative within our own departments, let alone with other institutions.
The library is at Dale and University, so drop by any time. It is 5 minutes from here.
It's already being loved to death, and it's only been open a couple of months.
And, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we also have a cooperative agreement with the community education section in St. Paul Schools. We've had that for nearly 30 years. We're working to reorganize that. We think we can enhance that as well. But we currently share space both in the recreation centers and the schools for cooperative programming that happens through our community education department.
And Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I drive by the Rondo every day and saw the plastic sheeting for a long time and stuff, so I couldn't resist popping in when it was finished. And it's a lovely place. And just to piggyback a little bit on the combination things, that Senator Anderson, if you remember, that's when I was talking about Onamia, the Rock Center, that's exactly what they did too. It's the Lions Club, the city, and the school got together, and it's ECFE, it's adult basic, it's the community center, it's a gymnasium, and it's a fitness center, and it's those three things that got together. They don't have a library in there, but they don't have a library in Onamia. So, but I do think that's right. That is a direction that we have to go, is combining those services so that we get maximum efficiency.
Senator Anderson, just a couple questions. On the as you're testifying on the proposal, at least this committee doesn't appropriate money to cities. Afraid that if we did, we probably would have Senator Bach sitting someplace in the committee. But I went back to the community education and. Area and kind of looked at that area of responsibility that they provide, and it was very consistent with, I think, some of the requests that you're looking at. The the services, adult basic education, youth development, youth service, early childhood and family education, school age care, summer programs for elementary and secondary students, youth after school enrichment programs, non-vocational, recreational, leisure activities. So, I mean, it's a very consistent, I think, area where, and I was wondering, and I assume that some of the funding for, like, the parks probably comes from community education or not, or is the working relationship between the school district and the parks
It's a cooperative agreement. We currently share, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we currently share funding for 5 staff positions, and we're reimbursed from the school district about $80,000 a year in supplies and other costs. So it's currently a cooperative agreement, and we do share the funding for our community education coordinators and one supervisor.
Is there a relationship in the libraries between the school districts and the libraries?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, not a funding relationship. We certainly have collaborative programmatic relationships, and we do some joint training and things like that when we can and when we're able to squeeze our way in there. But no, there's no joint funding relationships like that.
Mr. Chair, if it would be appropriate to funnel the dollars through the community education system, I don't think that would be a problem. If that would work, that'd be more appropriate.
That kind of jumped out as we're going through that, because usually city funding is kind of a responsibility of the tax committee, and I know it's hard enough to kind of keep up with all the school districts, let alone the cities, but I think the cause and the what you're trying to do is very worthwhile, because as the mayor, you mentioned, it's kind of the what's happening in the big picture, really, and all the activities that are surrounding our educational days. So, very good.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, we hear a lot of talk about extending the school day or extending the school year, and whether that's going to ever happen or not, I can't say. But this is an alternative. It's not exactly equivalent, of course, but it recognizes that there's those hours after school where kids still need opportunities to learn and grow and do things that go beyond just sports or the other things that they might be doing for fun.
Yeah, I think there's a limit as to what the school district can, or what can be done in the school itself. I think as we move forward, you probably want to have a lot of different kinds of activities, some school or educational activities are much higher cost than I think some of the other kinds of activities, and we want to distinguish that. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't want to have a highly trained special ed teacher probably running a general parks and recreation activity. And I mean, it's not a wise use of their training and their experience. So, all right, Senator Anderson, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, if
I do think that there has to be some changes, as I mentioned, as to where the money would go if this would be part of it.
Well, Mr. Chair, we can do that now or do that later, whatever your preference. I mean, if we can just do that as we move forward, that'd be fine. If I lay this on the table, we can always adjust the language.
What we would have to do would be to have an understanding that that's what it would be for. You know, ideally it would be nice to enhance the community education, so the idea that you're talking about, maybe other districts could participate or other communities, but I think the flow of the money would have to be through a school district.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. I think we could certainly work within those parameters.
Senator Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the community ed route, but I did have one quick question for the mayor. Will the centers be open on St. Patrick's Day?
That's a high holy day of obligation. We should all be home praying all day long.
Have green milk.
But on a serious note, that is one of the things. Marnie Wells, who directs what we are calling the second shift, which is the out-of-school time programming in the city, has worked very closely with Parks and Rec to open our rec centers during non-school days, so that this coming spring break, which starts April 1st, the rec centers will be open all day long, and not all of them. We're hoping to expand this program across the city, but I think 5 rec centers, Kathy, will be open, so that parents that don't have other means for daycare or for whatever for their children can drop their kids off. They won't just be babysat. They'll be engaged in meaningful activity. They'll be fed if they don't have food. But we are really, and I think it's one of the things I want to stress to the committee, is that St. Paul is primed to rethink how we do these programs for our children. And we're kind of focusing all of our resources to try to do things differently. And so now all of a sudden those kids that would have had nothing to do day after day after day, and I, you know, and a lot of our rec centers weren't open when kids were out of school. and now we're trying to change that. So St. Patrick's Day or others, they'll be open so that our kids can actually go on there and be productive.
Senator Anderson, I just wanted to recognize one other person that has become a strong member of your St. Paul team, Mr. Mike Wilhelmy, who used to work up here and actually worked for this committee for some time. So,
the jury's out still, Senator.
Well, thank you so much. We look forward
Senator
to
Anderson
working together.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 1183 with the appropriate amendments would be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 education bill. Any discussion or questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Senator Chair Anderson. And committee. Mm-hmm.
Senator Osteen, I'll set the goal. We have Senate File 715, and Senator Osteen, we're hoping that you have all the answers to career and technical vocational education.
Mr. Chair, I do.
That's a tall order.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, it's a pleasure to be before you on Senate File 715. Let me preface my remarks by saying that as a high school student, I spent 2 years going to vocational school, 916, and then I followed up with the postgraduate program there. And I was the first student to ever come back and serve on the 916 board of directors. So that was, I have a close affiliation to vocational ed and a pretty soft spot in my heart for education, vocational education. And I know as we talk so much about education and higher rigorous standards, I think we have to not forget the kids that are hands-on learners. And last night, education policy was at the STEP program in Anoka. And that was a very good example of just the kinds of things that I hope this bill will address. And with that, I have with me to testify, I have Inger Churchill and Tamara Urselman and Mo Amundsen. Yeah, they're all here. So with that, I'll
Sounds
turn
like
it over.
Great Norwegian team. Welcome. Nice to have you here. And if you could give your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Inger Churchill, and I work at Lakes Country Service Cooperative in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, as a secondary career and technical education program specialist. I have the responsibility at Lakes Country to serve 28 high schools in a 7-county area, and we serve 6,300 career and technical education students in those 28 high schools. I'm also currently the president of the Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Administrators. We are a statewide professional organization of administrators and those in leadership positions with career and tech ed. We represent the programs of agriculture, business and marketing, communication and information technology, construction, manufacturing, family and consumer sciences, transportation, health occupations, and work-based learning opportunities. These programs across the state of Minnesota serve over 163,000 career and technical education students in 337 districts in Minnesota. Our most recent data from the Department of Education indicates that 71% of high school students are also career and technical education students. And of those students, over 38% are what we call special population category students. Those are students economically disadvantaged, special education, teen parents, and English language learners. This bill is dedicated to serve through quality career and technical education programs any student in any district in the state of Minnesota. MACTA has collaborated with other professional associations
and has received their support and endorsement of this bill proposal, including the Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Education, with over 1,100 teacher members, the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, the Minnesota Association of Agriculture Educators, and the Minnesota Business Educators Incorporated. State funding dedicated for career and tech ed programs was last provided in 2001 and had been declining for the 13 years prior to that since 1988. Each of you have been provided information in your packets on the history of career and tech ed funding in Minnesota. So in order to perform or provide educational opportunities in career and technical education that we are charged with, such as STEM, the pathways through industry certification, connecting secondary education and post-secondary education, providing personalized learning environments for students, and that would be through our career and technical student organizations such as FFA, FCCLA, BPA, VICA, Skills USA, and to meet program standards from the Department of Education and in Minnesota rule, we are asking for this additional funding. This information is also available to you in your packet. We seek these additional resources in the form of state aid for career and technical education programs so that we may prepare students for the acquisition of core knowledge, skills, habits, and attitudes needed for success in post-secondary education and the highly skilled global marketplace. And now I would like to introduce to you my colleague, Tamara Usselman, Superintendent of Perm Dent Public Schools in Eastern Otter Tail County.
Welcome. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Give your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Tamara Usselman. I'm the superintendent from Perham Dent. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for allowing me to testify today. And I'd like to thank you for the important work that you do. My goal is to talk about career and tech ed from a very local perspective. And I'd like to tell you why I think it's important for Perham Dent students and, quite honestly, important for all students in the state. And this was brought to me really... The concept was brought to me by students. I had foreign exchange students all the time as a social studies teacher. I had them in my class. And one day, Kolya from Germany and Sam Hoogley from Switzerland stayed after my class, and they said, I find American schools an amusing place to be. It's where kids come to school and watch teachers do all the work. And that was a stunning, eye-opening thing for me to see, and it really made me think about my work as a teacher, and I had a paradigm shift, where I went from covering material to creating learning opportunities for kids to uncover material. And we call that constructivism. That's an educator language for it. My best model for learning how to do that was from career and tech ed. So I need you to know that career and tech ed is a hands-on, minds-on way of learning. It creates durable learning for students. And quite frankly, kids love it. That's where kids would choose to be. Today we know there's an 80-20 shift going on. We have 80% of our students going to a four-year college, and quite frankly, the workplace is asking for 20% of them to have that four-year degree. So we need to do in the high schools to help educate people about that conversion. In fact, so many kids are going to a four-year school and not finding employment as adults that the joke is career and tech ed for a two-year degree is the new master's program. They then return to a two-year program. So what could we do on the local level in a regular high school to help people become more aware of their opportunities? I think we have to get over the concept that career and tech ed is wonderful for the neighbor's kid, but everybody wants their own child to go to a four-year degree program. And how you do that is to get all of those kids involved in a career and tech ed class. And so I believe that creating opportunities for them to get to that coursework will create among students and families a more awareness so they can make a more informed choice. If they still choose a four-year or they choose a two-year, at least they know more about what they're choosing. So an infusion of cash, what would that do for my programs? It would provide money for tools that are very expensive, like lathes and computers and smart boards and software. Project Lead the Way engineering curriculum is something I want for my middle school. 100% of students can be successful in the middle school and engineering curriculum in that program, which is very much a STEM initiative. 80% of high school kids can be successful in engineering curriculum. And not all of them will be engineers, but that type of thinking and that way of using mathematics and science just opens doors for them, I believe, in their future. It would allow us to expand tools for agriculture education, and that's not the agriculture education that was around in the 60s and 70s. After the human genome was mapped, we have the hockey stick graph kind of coming along where there wasn't much change and wasn't much change, and then mapping of the genome, boom. Now ag science is really about biotechnology, and our ag science teacher needs tools to teach biotechnology. We basically have CSI, the show, going on our campus in our classrooms. We would use the money for GIS, geographic information systems, or the global mapping. Home construction is something that we teach in my school district, and kids are learning applied math. We have a math class tied to our industrial tech class, and if you've ever tried to build steps for your deck at home and weren't successful in doing it, you know that you can do the math, but applying the math is a much higher level skill. And we have those opportunities in a career and tech ed program. We can do things with architecture, we can do things with interior design. Certified nursing assistant is training that we offer. That's expensive training that we'd like kids to get a shot at the medical field by taking that. So in closing, I would tell you, I'm a superintendent who loves accountability. I think you should hold us accountable for all the money we get. I think there's no problem with accountability. But the thing I really love about career and tech ed is it isn't enough in terms of accountability to ask kids, what do you know? We must ask, what can you do with what you know? And that's what career and tech ed does for my curriculum. It creates opportunities for that durable learning where kids get to show you what they know, a very high degree of understanding on a very applied level. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Superintendent, that's a very, you know, stirring testimony. I think as I see you're energized. I would imagine that your school district is using the maximum levy for...
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Which school district?
Perham-Dent School District. Perham.
Okay.
Oh. It's a beautiful place. You should come there.
Mr. Chair, we also have Ms. Amundson from the Governor's Workforce Council.
Hey. Welcome, Ms. Amundson, if you could give your name for the record.
My name is Mo Amundson. I am speaking on behalf of the Governor's Workforce Development Council as Chair of the Education Committee. Our committee recognizes that we must increase the skilled workforce to keep Minnesota on the cutting edge economically. High school career and technical education programs, including but not limited to engineering, electronics, Microsoft certification, nursing assistant, biomedical technology, and pharmacy tech, offer all students a buffet of opportunity to explore careers that have work-based learning components, linking students directly to the local workforce. Increased career and technical education funding is a critical piece to provide our students with industry skill certifications, college credits, and transition to post-secondary education, which offers community-driven workforce opportunities. Each of our communities faces increasing workforce demands. In order to meet those demands, we need to recognize that career and technical education programs train our students to be part of a highly qualified workforce, expanding the economic development of our local communities. Career and technical education is the driving force behind high-skill, high-wage careers. And I ask you to support this bill for the economic development of our state and also for all of our students. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Osteen, am I understanding this bill right, that what you're asking for is a match in state aid of 25% of what you're levying?
There's two components, actually.
Senator
and
Osteen.
I'll hand that over to Ms. Churchill.
Ms. Churchill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and the committee members. We understand that our proposal is a match to the current levy, which is being maximized by nearly every district in the state of Minnesota at this point.
So, Mr. Chair, so then if we were to go forward with this approach, this would we would be enhancing what schools were able to spend in this area by they would show us their expenditures, or we would base it on their levy amount? That I'm still confused between their actual expenditures. Do they spend more than what they levy?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And so could you, Mr. Chair, help me understand?
I think what the understanding I have is that before 2001, there was an aid. Before 2001, there was an aid levy component to career and technical education funding. After 2001, the aid portion was pulled, or something happened to it. I think they say it was rolled into something, but obviously when you hear the word rolled into, you usually mean disappear.
Right.
So the levy portion also was really disappeared at that time, I think. I don't think we hung on to the levy portion until we got that back, actually, didn't we? Mr. Nauman, probably.
We hung on.
Mr. Chairman, I think the way to think about this is that 2 years ago we recreated. We had a levy, but it was checked back to the 2001 revenue that districts had, which had an aid and levy component. And so it was an aging formula in that it had a look back to 2001 and didn't really reflect the state of the world as we have moved forward. So the governor's recommendation, which was ultimately approved by the legislature and signed into law, was an update of the formula. And that's the formula that you have in front of you. However, it's an all-levy formula. So this bill that you have in front of you today does not provide any new revenue to school districts for career and technical. Instead, what it does is convert the levy portion. It transplants levy with aid. So it's an aid levy mix question. It's not a revenue question.
So,
okay, and I'm not sure. In my estimation, I think what's needed out there is more revenue.
That's what I was going to say.
And I think whether, and I know this committee and its budget is quite limited in terms of aid, obviously, because of the restrictions we have. So I think the question is how, first of all, what do you need? Do you need more revenue? And secondly, how do we get there?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Osteen.
Ms. Churchill has a response.
Churchill.
Again, Mr. Chair, we understand that the revenue, the aid that we are seeking in this bill is in addition to the levy, which is being in a process of being recalculated by the Minnesota Department of Education, which will bring it up to date from 2001, which are past expenditures. You can imagine the amount of change going on in career and technical education programs in the last 6 years. To even bring that levy formula up to date is not enough for the demands of equipment, technology, and new materials that our career and technical education programs do seek. We are seeking the revenue aid in addition to what is available through the levies.
I'm not sure the legislation does that, though. Senator Bonhoff,
thank you, Mr. Chair, because that I did read it that way, that in fact we were going over and above the levy by 25%, that we were using aid dollars to go over and above what was levied. That was how I read the bill, which I too think we should be finding a way to add revenue, because I think we've identified as a committee this is something we want to support. So I'm hoping that in some way, I don't know the mechanism, that we do find a way to add revenue.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify. I don't think we ever dropped anything totally. We dropped the aid, but the it was transformed to a permissive levy that districts could continue to levy that was the, it couldn't be exceed the amount that they had expended, but it was frozen at that level at that date. So they've been able to continue to levy that amount, which has diminished in impact with each year. But it was kind of like hanging on by the fingernails to have it even recognized until we could, you know, work to see if we could get something that was more functional. And I do believe that even though the philosophy at the time of rolling things in was, you know, let it be local decision, which often meant I think we lost a lot of programming back at that time. The figures that you were sharing about the numbers of students involved in a vocational program were a bit startling to me. I didn't think that we had gone that far in terms of hanging on. But I do know that there's been a renewed, certainly an appreciation and understanding on the part of our committees the last several years of recognizing that we need programs of this sort, and I think we've been getting more and more reinforcement of that. I appreciated, Superintendent, your sharing what you're doing up in your part of the world. Last night, some of us were out at the Anoka-Hennepin District for our off-site hearing, and the STEP program has been a model. And it was quite remarkable, the variety of programs and applied. I mean, they're ready to be able to offer, you know, they meet the standards for academic programs. And these young people were just turned on and doing exceptionally well. And probably the epitome of it was one young man that was a senior at Groves Academy, which is an academy for disabled young people that often aren't you know, can't be served in their high school. And he was up there. He had won an award for the computer that he built, and he presented both before to those of us that had a brief little tour ahead of time, as well as the committee, in very articulate fashion what he had done and what this had done to turn him into an A student. And it was quite remarkable, and I think that it's people are starting to realize that the academics are both appreciated and learned more effectively for many young people if they're learned in a context of something that prepares them to do something with them. Yes. And even if they may not pursue that specific area, it has had that effect, and they are, you know, are equipped to go on. So I do, you know, on the one hand, I think it's helping people in our districts realize that we do need these programs and willing to acknowledge that with their own local investment. But there are still additional costs to these programs that I think we ought to find a way to restore some of that means of funding. So whether it's exactly the way this is, I certainly am committed to work with you, Senator Stump, to see if we can't find the way to start us moving down that track.
Senator Worthing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I sincerely wish there were more members sitting at the table right now. I'm a co-author on this bill, and if it doesn't do what we're looking for, then I sure hope we change the wording and we do something about it, because and maybe most of the people in this room know it. I'm sure they do, because a lot of them are education professionals. But there are three styles of learning. You have the visual learner. That's me. If you put it up on a PowerPoint, if you hand me a piece of paper with it on, if you give me a menu with pictures, I'm a happy camper, because I see it, I learn it, I remember it. Okay, that's an easy style of learning, because the world around you is full of that type of learning. The second learner is the audio learner. If you tell them, if you hear them, if they hear a great lecture, they're going to put it in their head. I'm still into the paper, not the audio, so that doesn't work for me. The third style of learner that we lose sight of so easily is the kinesthetic learner. That's the third child in the classroom that's getting lost in the classroom. My son is a kinesthetic learner, and I had 100 foster girls, and most of them were kinesthetic learners. The way they learn math is in the kitchen, with a measuring cup or a tablespoon or pieces of something. A kinesthetic learner is someone who learns through touch. It's almost like if you put your hand on their shoulder, they learn by osmosis through your fingers. But if they see a picture or they hear it, they aren't necessarily going to get it. The kinesthetic learner oftentimes ends up in a special education class because it's kind of mistaken that they can't learn or they aren't learning for some reason. But it's because they're in a classroom with 30 kids and they don't get that hands-on. Of my foster kids, if they could get into some kind of a technical class where they could touch things to learn them that way, their school experience, and it just got so much better. And I would think that there are so many kids out there that were missing with the kinesthetic learning piece. And Career in Tech Ed does a lot of the kinesthetic learning. We ought to figure out a way to get more hands-on learning integrated throughout all of school. I know that's impossible right now, but at the same time, let's do this for that huge population, that bunch of kids that learns through kinesthetic learning and can't get it sitting in a classroom with a lecture.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate the testimony of Senator Olson and Senator Worgen. But I suspect under 1.8 to 1.10, doesn't that address the concerns? And then following at 111 and 113 is the multipliers. Is that correct?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I have had a chance to visit with some individuals that have been done some work on this, and I think I can clarify the point. I know the understanding is that this bill would produce some more revenue, and I think we ought to do some vetting with the department because I'm uncertain it accomplishes that. And the reason for that is that on the calculations on line 2.8 and 2.10, it says 25% of the approved expenditures under subdivision 1, which is a cross-reference back to the first page, which calculates the existing levy. And I think it's reasonable to interpret that you're talking about 25% of the amount that's already approved, and the question is, are you taking a subset of the revenue that's already calculated, or are you adding additional revenue? And I think that the legislation at best is unclear about that. So I think to the extent that you're looking for additional revenue on that, we would need to clarify that point a little.
Mr. Chairman, it does say it's eligible for career and technical education aid in an amount equal to 25% of the expenditures. It doesn't say the amount is 25%. It's the same basis that was used for the levy is the same basis. So, in other words, if you've documented those expenditures for the levy, that's also what would make you eligible for
exactly.
the aid. That's how I read that. But if there's another word that would make you, or word change that would make you more comfortable, I believe that's what it says.
I think we get the general approach, and I'm glad that you gave the testimony that you did. It was very, very good. Members, I think we're going to have to kind of move along. We got several more bills that are going to have some involved testimony, but we're going to work with you, Senator Olson, on this, and I know there's a number of members around the table that are interested in this. So.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Worgen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill, hoping that we make the necessary changes to it for language purposes to accomplish what we want, but I'll move it for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Senator Worgen, with the caveat that we'll work on that, be sure that we get the understanding that we have. On Senate File 715, is there any other questions that members have on that? If not, all those that the 715 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 education finance bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Olson, and thank you, member, your team up there that came and testified.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, we have
Public Library.
Senator Olson, Public Libraries.
Ah, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of investment in my political life in supporting libraries. As a county commissioner, I brought forth a resolution in Chisago County to build 3 new libraries and to purchase a fourth one. So it was quite a controversial issue, and we built three new libraries, and we purchased the other building from a city. And so we've really got a lot of investment in our library system. And then I was able also to serve as a commissioner on the East Regional Library Board, East Central Regional Library Board. And the striking thing is that library funds have not been increased from the state for over 10 years. And so we're in, when we talk about local property taxes, here's another one of those shifts where to continue with these library services, it's depending more and more on local property taxes. Plus, I don't think we're getting the services that we really could from the libraries. And so I have a whole crew here to testify. And
If I could just have you give your name for the record, and then I would ask if you could keep your testimony as brief as possible. We do have several others, and we'd like to get that all in before 11 o'clock. Thank you.
Welcome. And just Andrew. My name is Chris Olson. I'm the executive director of the Metropolitan Library Service Agency, better known as MELSA, which is the regional public library system based here in the Twin Cities metro area. I've come before you today in support of Senate File 623, the bill which will provide additional state support for regional public library system support. During the past 15 years, the world of libraries has really changed dramatically. Libraries continue in their role of providing a wide range of services, from early learning to school success to job search and business support, through technology literacy and community engagement. What has changed are the tools and opportunities for sharing those resources efficiently around the state. The legislature has appropriated such tools as the MinLink Gateway to provide access to all materials in libraries all across the state. However, this burden in the last 15 years of state funding or static funding for regional libraries that provide the way that those materials are delivered has really fallen onto the local units of government. The investment of local dollars for these services reduces the ability of local libraries to improve collections, the services that we have, and increase hours of opening in our libraries. What I'd like to point out to you rather quickly is the handouts that we gave. There's a folder here with a nifty tab that you can put into your files that will say library, so you can collect all your library stuff in here. And there's a couple of sheets in here to just point out some of the reasons why we're asking for this $5 million increase to the current level. As Senator Olson said, we have not seen an increase in funding since 1992. The money is used in a variety of ways in different libraries across the state. Sometimes it's with books and collections. Many times it's with automated library systems. Sometimes it's to do delivery and interlibrary loan and sharing of materials from libraries to libraries. In our region, or in the MELSA region, one fine example is trying to do cooperation among all types of the public libraries in the areas. We mentioned Senator Anderson mentioned the Museum Venture Pass program. That's a program that was started because of MELSA staff going out, working with local museums and local public libraries. And where that could have happened maybe locally, okay, it really has taken a huge impact because we've all worked together. And that's what state dollars can do. There's also things about telecommunications, which you may hear in other hearings, and then really a good sheet about reciprocal borrowing and delivery. And this is really the major impact that public libraries have seen in the last couple of years, is that the MinLink system has been a fantastic, popular, successful organization where the public can come in, look in one place, find what kind of library materials are available throughout the entire state, push a button, and have it delivered to your local library. But that has created expenses for us. We've also been fairly successful in going out and talking to counties around the state and also local cities. And you'll see on the yellow sheet a listing of all the counties and cities that have passed a resolution in support for increased funding for regional public libraries. And part of that is because of the logic that's shown on the ivory sheet that talks about how public libraries really have been impacted in reductions of service throughout the state because of the dwindling funding that we have.
Thank you very much. You have some others there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have Ms. Kunkel from the Cannon Falls Library.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janice Kunkel. I'm the director of the Cannon Falls Public Library. After my colleagues here from St. Paul were here earlier, I had to jot down. We had 74,000 visitors last year. We're a much smaller library, but with our proximity to the metro and our location on Highway 52 between St. Paul and Rochester, we are a quickly growing community, and the expectations that our patrons have, what they're going to get in library service, are rapidly changing as well. And we rely highly on our regional library for support services and for those connecting pieces that Chris mentioned, interlibrary loan, our automation system, that tie us in with a great network of libraries in our own region and across the state to really get a lot more bang for our buck and provide services for our patrons. Again, as Chris mentioned, with no increase in the state money for the regional library systems, we've seen increases in the fees that we pay regional library provide those services at the same time that we're seeing reductions in service. We can't continue to do the same thing with less money. So some of the things, the interlibrary loan is a key component. We have a large homeschooling population in our community. We have quite a few authors, actually, in Cannon Falls, a lot more telecommuters and distance learners. And so they rely on us to be able to provide a wealth of information. And there's only so much we can do locally. Our city has been more than generous in increases in recent years, and our county has provided steady increases in funding. But it's all that we can do to keep up just with the local demand in our rapidly growing community. And so we rely on interlibrary loan to get those more diverse materials from outside of our community in for our growing population. It's that regional component is what leverages those local dollars. It helps us provide that breadth and depth that we can't do locally without that. The other key piece for us that we see at the regional library level is the automation. I said often, I'm a library geek, not a computer geek. Luckily, the computer geek from Selco is at my library right now doing upgrades to my computer while I'm here to talk to all of you. Again, there's so much changing so rapidly, and I'm so grateful to the regional library system that has been set up in the state of Minnesota that I'm able to concentrate on library work in the more traditional sense and not have to try and keep up with all the technology because I couldn't do it. I'm sure you all know that in your own lives, too, that keeping up with technology is a full-time job. So for us to be able to use those resources, the state resources, and pool some of our local money to take on that technology piece, that really helps us concentrate at the local level at providing those day-to-day services, the FaceTime with patrons, purchasing books, planning programs, those sorts of things that we do better. Within Selco, I think it's also interesting to note that the Regional Library Basic System support money provides just 38% of the operational costs of our library automation system. 40% of those costs are currently funded through fees paid by the member libraries, and then the remainder comes from other state and federal programs such as the Library Telecom Federal E-Rate program. Again, static funding since 92 has meant that those costs continue to fall more and more on the local tax dollars as we pay those membership fees. Just as a example, in 1995, our automation fees for the Cannon Falls Library were about $775 a month. This year we're paying about $1,100 a month for the automation fees for our interconnectivity with the other libraries and the technology support that we get from the region. So basically, I think regional library systems are a great idea, and they've proven their worth. They bring every resident of Minnesota a wide world of information. Each local city and county library uses our local resources to provide good localized service to our primary population. But then we also contribute
back into that statewide system, and it makes the libraries in Minnesota among the best in the nation. So I, again, am here to ask you to fund that increase of $5 million so that the infrastructure established with the regional library systems can continue to work in our libraries, and we can continue to work for all Minnesotans.
Thank you very much. Senator Osteen?
Mr. Chair, I have Ms. Post from the Central Minnesota Libraries Exchange.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patricia Post. I'm the director of the Central Minnesota Libraries Exchange, the Central Minnesota multi-county, multi-type library system. The seven multi-type library systems strengthen Minnesota by providing support services to all our librarians and by facilitating cooperation among all types of libraries, and that includes academic, public, K-12 school media centers, and special libraries, including those we might forget, like the ones in hospitals, historical societies, law libraries, and prisons, to name a few. The seven regional multi-types serve 1,915 Minnesota libraries of all types, but 66% of those member libraries are school media centers. You will notice that this bill also includes funding for the multi-county, multi-type library systems, who do not get county dollars, they just get a state grant. Services vary by region, but basic core services are evident in each multi-type system. In all cases, our member libraries meet a set of guidelines to become a member. Resource sharing is a big part of membership in a system. And we all have staff who act as consultants or facilitators to assist in grant writing, planning, or in solving various library-related problems. Multi-types make things happen in a variety of ways. We make sure that library materials and expertise of librarians are shared amongst our member libraries and across the regions. We specialize in building the capacity of our librarians through both one-on-one coaching and also with professional development activities. We accept our role as support organizations, and we strive to make our member libraries stronger. One important way we support our member libraries is through many communication systems, including web pages, email, webinars, podcasts, newsletters. You get the idea. Examples provide a practical way to see how libraries in this state are working together. Next, when I'm done, you'll hear from our school media specialist from the Holdingford Schools, and she is a member of my multi-type. One of our star services in central Minnesota at CMLE is the Interlibrary Loan Service. This service demonstrates very well what can happen when a multi-type like mine is located at and drawing from the resources of a state university, which in my case is St. Cloud State. We're able to respond easily to requests of our member libraries for loans of materials. So Debbie Disher will talk about the needs of Holdingford K-12 schools and how the cooperation of the multi-type, the academic, and the public libraries have helped fill needs. Although local academic libraries in our region are all willing to share their materials, an entity like my organization is needed to mediate those requests. In this case, St. Cloud State provides the library materials, technology support, and importantly, student workers to augment my staff and very limited budget in filling over 7,000 requests for loans each year. The public library assists in delivering the requested materials to libraries in close proximity to the schools, and then the schools drive to the public library to get the materials. This is a fantastically efficient use of our $120,000 a year annual grant, and it's a wonderful collaboration among libraries. My handout today is very simple. It's this one. It's not very fancy, but it shows a sample of the organizations who use our CMLE services in central Minnesota. The document is arranged alphabetically by city name, so you can quickly scan and see if any of your constituents are listed in there. Multi-types make things happen by identifying these types of efficiencies across all member libraries and promoting ways to take advantage of these efficiencies whenever possible. We do promote cost sharing when it makes sense, but after 10 years of flat funding, we've nearly exhausted our bag of tricks for squeezing a nickel with our flat budgets, which in truth are declining budgets when we factor in inflation. We are truly at a breaking point. We have already cut services, but in some cases we'll need to shut down core services like the Interlibrary Loan Service that I described here. thank you for any help you can offer with our funding situation and for your support of libraries. And now Debbie Disher will talk.
Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Debbie Disher, and I'm the K-12 media specialist for Holdingford Public Schools, which serves approximately 1,000 students in central Minnesota. Unfortunately, my district has been in statutory operating debt for some time, so our media centers have suffered. Our high school media center has been very neglected, and with budgets being so tight and dollars stretched in so many different directions, there never is enough money. Although book prices have dramatically increased, my book budget has stayed the same, and this next year we'll be taking a great decrease. It's not uncommon to see reference books costing from anywhere between $60 and $100 each. A large portion of our collection is over 20 years old, having been published before 1985. So our students as well as staff have become very dependent on our Central Minnesota Libraries Exchange to support our curriculum with current materials. Our Media Center staff has also taken advantage of some of the low-cost workshops available through Central Minnesota Library Exchange, as well as those interlibrary loan opportunities. Last year, we borrowed 270 titles from CMLE. This year, thanks to CMLE and their cooperation with Great River Regional Public Library, we participate in their Red Bag program, where any materials we borrow are delivered to the Upsala branch of Great River Regional Library, and then I pick them up 3 times a week and deliver them to our school. This saves us in transportation costs, which I wouldn't have a way to cover. It is cost-effective for taxpayers to support the multi-type libraries so that they can provide schools with those titles that we may only use once a year, and therefore those titles can be shared with many different places. Our elementary teachers discover book titles from journal articles they read, and if we don't have a particular title in our own collection, we're able to borrow those from CMLE. Our high school students occasionally use these resources for their personal reading, but the vast majority of students are using the resources for research for classes that they're taking. We're all working hard to increase the rigor in our classrooms, and this puts more demands on our media centers and the materials that are required. Borrowing materials from other libraries helps meet those requirements. I firmly believe that the students of Holdingford deserve the same access to materials as the students in larger, more affluent districts. So I hope that you'll be able to support this bill and give us an opportunity to borrow materials from multi-type libraries and public libraries.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody here from the department working with the libraries? And we are going to have to move so we have some of the other. We have three bills that we do need to get done by 11 because that's really our last time. The question I have for the department is in the federal funds that we get from the federal government, it's not real clear to me when I look at how the federal pass-through to the libraries, I think, is supposed to be like 96%. And if I look at some of the information, it looks like it's less than that. And I'm just wondering if you could clarify that for me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Miller. I'm state librarian, a member of the Department of Education for the state of Minnesota. I'm not sure what you mean by pass-through to the libraries. Our federal funds are governed by federal statute, which has three particular targeted purposes. Mm-hmm. And so it's distributed based on those targeted purposes under a 5-year plan, which is devised by the librarians across the state to meet state needs. There is only 4% of that, the federal funding that we receive, that is retained for administrative purposes within the department. That cap is established by the federal statute. The rest of it is not pass-through money, but it is appropriate or it is dispensed based on the purposes of the federal statute.
So part of that 96% that's supposed to flow through to statewide projects is used for things that would not necessarily be, they would be capacity and support and other kinds of projects. It seems to me like some of it kind of fringes on like administration kinds of things.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, there are certain funds that are used for staffing at the department and the Library for the Blind because the state because we do not have state funds to do that. But it does fall within the policies of the federal statute that these meet the policies of serving under the underserved. And so we can use some of that money for that purpose. We spend approximately $800,000 a year in competitive grants. This is for not capacity, because these grants are not supposed to be for capacity, but rather for program building and model programs, new initiatives. It gives libraries the opportunity and the ability to create new partnerships, like you were talking about earlier, that gives that they can be free to do that with this money and do some creative work. We also support statewide initiatives through the federal funds like the Minnesota Digital Library Coalition and the Minitex. We do send a lot of money to our funding to Minitex to support the delivery system, the backbone, statewide backbone for the interlibrary loan and resource sharing delivery system.
What is the LDS?
When I came on to the into the Department of Education, the State Library Services is our division. It used to be called LDS or Library Development Services. So the division has gone through a number of different name changes over the last several years.
Okay. It seems like it could be a little bit clearer, because in the budget book on page 257, it looks like the federal funds that we receive are a whole lot less than what we really are getting. I think the total federal funds are like...
It's 2.7 million, Mr. Chair.
2.7, and in it seems like it's not quite as clear as it.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I do recognize your confusion, because I actually had some of it. The way that the department, I questioned it because I thought they were siphoning a lot of the money that I'm supposed to be responsible for.
That's what I thought.
Just to be perfectly honest. But what they've done is the way that they have parsed it out in the budget book this time. And the 2.7 is actually all there. It's just that they parsed it out. I don't know if it's Department of Finance or the Department of Education, but they parsed it out into the different places that they're spending the money. And so it's hard to pull it together.
All right. Okay. The governor had recommended a small increase, I think, in a couple areas. One, I think, was on 2% on the basic support, and then also 2% on the statewide comprehensive libraries. Well, actually, that's a study. So I think the governor's recommendation was just for a very modest support or modest increase in the basic support. So Senator Osteen will have to, I think the request that you're would like to see is significantly higher than that. But
Mr. Chair, that is correct. However, in the rural part of the state, when we talk about many millions of dollars at these tables, a few millions of dollars will make a huge difference in these library systems.
Okay. I think so.
I mean, I think on the table for consideration.
Right, right. I think we definitely have support for libraries. I think in this committee, and it's important as to we don't know exactly how much we can. Work to fit everything in, but definitely, I think the committee has always been very supportive of all that you do and all the different facets of it. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just have to say a little, very briefly, for the benefit of the witnesses here. My son, who's 7, came home last night. He went to a library with his friend, a library that we don't usually go to, and he came home and he was like, "Mom, they let me use my library card at this other library. It was so cool." And so I just told him, yeah, we have a great library system in Minnesota, and the legislature, that's trying to explain what we do here. We try to support that. Just wanted to let you know that.
Okay, Senator Olson, you want to make a motion?
Mm-hmm.
That, let's see here, what was it? The Senate file.
623.
Be laid on the table for be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 education bill. Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Therese Ray, we're going to skip Senate file, just temporarily, Senator Saltzman's Senate file 295, and we'll come back to that. She's not here right now. So, Senator Therese Ray.
And thank you, members of the committee.
And again, I think...
We're going to go very quickly, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 908. I'm here to ask for your support to renew and make permanent and special bonding authority for Minneapolis and St. Paul to issue $15 million in general obligation bonds for building improvements. I am here with Mr. Gradwell and Ms. Gilbert, who will help me explain this and respond to some of the questions that the committee may have. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill will give bonding authority without voter election in order to meet the needs identified in a plan filed with and approved by the Commissioner of Education. We have done this in the past, and we are coming here today to ask for your support this time again.
Thank you, Senator Treasury.
Thank you.
Mr. Grathwell.
Mr. Chair and members, Jim Grathwell with Minneapolis Public Schools. So this would be our third time before the committee renewing this authority. And who knows, maybe the third time does pay for all. This is an authority. It's general obligation bonds. We use it to basically maintain, renew, and keep as good educational environments the assets we have for Minneapolis. It's about 79 buildings. It's $1.2 billion in fixed assets. We've been using this authority to put in lunchroom facilities, renew gymnasia, put in media centers, science centers, keep our classrooms, add classroom space. It's all local levy authority, and it's you should be proud of the fact that in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in part because of this authority, kind of the national story of crumbling urban infrastructure is just not a fact of life here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have buildings you can be proud of. We are landlocked. We do have older facilities. This authority was granted to allow us to keep, maintain, and modernize those facilities.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Gilbert. Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. This was part of a program that was developed in collaboration with the Department of Education when they were taking a look at the condition of our buildings. And as Mr. Grathwell said, we are landlocked. When we have to try and expand a site, we have to condemn buildings and move families. Generally, there's more than one family living in a household. So we have some unique expenditures related to that. Just in comparison, Representative Dietrich actually was at Central the other day, and she was kind of struck by the difference in the quality of the facilities we had due to our age and also the overuse of our facilities. Because we are so landlocked, there isn't space either for parks and recs or, as the mayor talked about, or to expand sites. And so all of our facilities are incredibly overused, and so they have to be maintained on a more regular basis. We've also had to make, because of the sharp increase in the types of populations that we have, accommodations for our special needs. Since our buildings are quite a bit older, dealing with some of the handicap accessibility, dealing with some of the new technologies, dealing with some of the self-contained classrooms that are necessary for the EBD and autistic kids, we've had to make those accommodations, sometimes actually separate classrooms, separate entrances, separate labs for that.
Is the does St. Paul have the authorization currently for the $15 million?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is just to renew it.
Okay, and Minneapolis has the authorization for the $15
million. Yes, sir.
And the if you would not use that up before 2008, then you'd have to have new legislation passed to give you the authority to use that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct, sir.
And so the purpose of doing it right now is that then we won't have to worry about coming back and maybe, you know, not having it, you not having, or the district not having to basically go through the legislative process to give you the authorization to use the current existing $15 million bond authorization that each of the districts has. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
I read that it's available each year,
right,
this amount. It's not just using the current. It says for each calendar year after 2008, an amount not to exceed $15 million. So it will continue on. Not only able to use what's in the existing law, but they'll be able to continue it at that level each year.
Is
on one
Senate
line,
Council with the
12 and 13.
What does that really say? Hate to put you on the spot. But, yeah, 1.12 and 1.13. Does each year mean that that's $15 million each year?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. And part of the purpose of having the renewal is because we have, with the number of facilities we have and the list of requests to do the upgrades, we have a long waiting list for each of the buildings and each of the programs. And having the ability to plan over time allows us the ability to let, you know what I mean, to let at least one group know or one building know that based on our priorities, that they will eventually be taken care of as a result of the reauthorization of the bonding authority.
And, Mr. Chair and members, the current authority is a $15 million annual authority. The renewal would be of that current $15 million a year annual authority.
So the $15 million, let's see, where does it say that?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonhoeff.
It says that on line 1.11, it says for calendar years 2004 to 2008, an amount not to exceed $15 million, and they're adding, it's really just taking off the sunset. That provision, it sunsetted in 2008, so with the addition of this language, there is no sunset on their ability to levy up to $15 million a year.
Senator Bonhoeff, I think, I mean, there's obviously possible differences in interpretation. My read of it is that between 2004 and 2008, you have a total of $15 million in authorizations. Right?
Per year.
Where does it say per year?
Well, it's years. It says
for calendar years 2004 to 2008 an amount not to exceed $15 million.
For each calendar year.
It doesn't say each calendar year.
Yeah, it does.
For each calendar year.
For calendar years.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it goes, Mr. Chairman?
The new language. Senator Olson?
It starts in on line 1.8 where they can issue and sell in each calendar year general obligation bonds of the district in an amount not to exceed 5 1/10% of the taxable property in the parents plus for these years an amount not to exceed.
Okay. Senator Council or Mr. Nolan?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there's probably two issues here. I think I read the $15 million as an annual authority. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the bill is asking you to do, they're asking you, one, to extend the existing $15 million, but they're also asking the committee to approve this $15 million essentially forever. Under current law, the city's the city districts come back with periodically every few years, and this committee reviews this authority and grants it to them. Under this bill, it's somewhat different in that the authority is being asked for 2008 and later. So the only reason the districts would have to come back would be to change the $15 million. Members can see that back in 1990 to 2003, there was $7.5 million. So beginning in 2004, we increase that to 15.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Bonner,
it looks to me like then we would have to carry on our books every single year that amount, and so that seems like.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, we would carry $2.4 million as the debt service cost associated with this on the levy side beginning in taxes payable 2010. We wouldn't carry $15 million. That's the amount that the districts would collectively have to levy to service these bonds. So we're giving them new bonding authority, and then to service those bonds, it's about $2.4 million
a year. Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonhoff?
And wouldn't we have to carry it on the property tax side?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, absolutely.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Chair?
Senator Wergen?
If you have to carry $2.4 million as a result of the $15 million bond, wouldn't that be cumulative? Because if each year they did $15 million, it isn't paid off the next year, so it'd be cumulative.
We do that already.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wergen, you have landed onto some of the peculiarities of how we track things. In an effort to track things as comprehensively as possible, we have added what we call the tails, and that's as we sit here today, that's fiscal years 10 and 11. This would not begin to take effect until fiscal year, the debt service payments for which the districts would levy would not actually begin to hit the books until fiscal year 11, which is taxes payable 2010. You're right. However, it's the cumulative effect doesn't get seen until what I affectionately refer to as the deep tails, beyond our tracking.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, also to clarify that you already do this. I mean, the districts are here to ask for your support in continuing to do this without having to come here every year to ask for this. But this is happening. They just come here and ask for your support to do it. So I think the purpose of this is to ask for support so that they don't have to come here every time to do it, because that's what has been happening. But we're not changing, the formula, or we're not changing the amount of money that is being requested. That is the same.
But I'm sure, Senator Desiree, you want to come and tell us what good things you're doing in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'm sure.
I am just looking forward to that. We just changed the board and our direct. Everything is changing in Minneapolis.
Chairman,
so.
Senator Olson.
Just so we don't have to hear any complaints about raising property taxes.
Oh. Well, I do think they're probably. I can understand the concern about 2008, but I think there is some benefit to some review, and I don't have a problem with extending it another 4 years and letting that process come back. Who knows what'll happen or who'll be here? You probably want to increase that from 15 to 30 or something. So you'd probably be back anyway.
That's right.
So, but is everything else kind of in order?
Make it another 4 years. That would do it. Right.
Well, I
maybe you wouldn't have one next year.
All right, I think we get the gist of it, and I appreciate
your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman members. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Senator Esrae.
Do I need to move?
Have another,
or do I need to move a motion?
Yeah, please,
I didn't do
please
that.
Make a motion.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, and I move that Senate File 908 be recommended for possible inclusion in the E-12 Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. Senator Therese Ray moves that Senate File 908, as we make some adjustments to it, be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the E-12 Education Finance Omnibus.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. If we do this in the Omnibus Bill, I sure hope that we remember some of the other special requests for levying from some of the other districts, because their needs might be different, but they're just as sincere as St. Paul's. And this is huge authority for one district, so maybe we can do something minor for the others that have asked.
Thank you. On Senator Therese Ray's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to do the next one I have, or how would you like to proceed
sure.
with
Why
the schedule?
Sure. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll get Senator
okay.
Salzman's bill
okay.
after that.
He said
okay. I believe you have an amendment, Senator
okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to present this important bill to you and the members of the committee. I am honored to be here with a leader of the American Indian community who will help me present the case today. I have to share with committee members and with you, Mr. Chair, that I have learned a lot through this process, and that it just has been an incredible opportunity and a reminder that a lot of the work that we do with the American Indian community sometimes is not it's difficult to coordinate the work that we do here with the work that needs to happen at the community level. So today I am going to be asking to move an amendment to delete the language that I had previously, and present this new amendment that has brief language for this particular bill. So I think it's the, I don't know the number of this amendment, I think it's AO7 mm-hmm. or?
Yeah, that's the AO7 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I would like to move that we amend Senate 586. It's a delete everything amendment. It's the AO7 amendment.
Senator Therese Ray moves the AO7 amendment to Senate File 586. Everybody has that? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Therese Ray.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity again. Senate File 587 will create a pilot project to promote activities and programs that are specific to promoting revitalization of indigenous languages for American Indian people. I want to share with you, members of the committee, that there are only 14 Dakota fluent speakers and 300 Ojibwe speakers in the state of Minnesota, and that it is urgent that we provide funding to the American Indian community and to the state of Minnesota to preserve a language that is on the verge of extinction. The pilot project that I am presenting today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, will develop programs that will help children from pre-kindergarten to 12th grade and adults who are interested in learning these languages, and it will identify programs that are necessary to preserve the languages. The pilot project will also allow different groups to come together to talk about what is the most effective way to do this for the state of Minnesota. Again, I have the honor to be here with a leader that I have worked with for many, many years, Mr. John Poupart, who will help me present the case and answer some questions to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Therese Wright. Welcome, and if you could give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Poupart. I am the facilitator for the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance, which is a group of really interested folks, mostly in the metro areas, some reservation input. And we are working on behalf of preserving and revitalizing our language. And part of the spinoff of this language effort is not only to revitalize the language, but also to assist in improving the academic indicators of our children, K through 12 and preschool. On a broader historical approach involving my family as well, this legislation will help relieve some of the negative residual effects of the federal boarding schools. As some of you may know, that the boarding school era began in 1879, and one of the prominent schools was the Carlisle Indian School at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, started by Richard Pratt, whose most infamous statement was to kill the Indian in him and save the man. Although those were the attempts to do away with the Indians' way of life, their traditions, and most of all their language, which our identity and our oral history is couched within. And it is those things that I think about and that are most closest to my heart, as my parents were products of a boarding school as well, where they were forced to leave their language behind. And at home, they would speak the native language to each other. But when turning to me, they would use English. I know English is the predominant language in this country, and I think the reason they did that was to help me to avoid some of the cruelties that they suffered through in their years of growing up. So I testify today on behalf of those Indians who don't know how this political process and public policy process works. And I testify here in the name of the elders who can't be here, for all those elders who aren't here, for those who have passed on and who took the language with them. Since time immemorial, my people have handed this language down from generation to generation. It was never written down. And we're now here We are the current members of the seventh generation, where seven generations ago our people said we will make a place for our people seven generations from now. And they prepared us to survive, and I'm one of those survivors. So today I testify to you in hopes of those people seven generations from now can say, I still speak the language. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Poupart. Did you have a question, Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I did have a question as to whether, but I think you stated that you are a part of this organization. This organization isn't one established by the law, but it's one that's existing that would be eligible through this for a grant that would be distributed through the Office of Higher Education.
Senator Terezre.
Correct. Yes, I think Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, part of what happened with the previous language is that we had really dictated how this needs to occur, how the council will be structured, and we received a lot of feedback, and we have decided that we're going to simply support the effort, and then with the community establish a structure that will build on programs that already exist, work with organizations that are already doing the work, and when needed, we may expand or create new programs. But there is a lot that is in place already, so organizations that are already doing the work, of course, will be eligible to apply. But the criteria is not dictated through this process.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but it looks like everything in this seems to point that it ought to be in the higher education budget. It goes to the Office of Higher Education, and it's for the purposes of both developing the curriculum and the instruction of teachers, the teacher preparation. Do we fund the teacher preparation?
Senator Olson, you're absolutely correct.
And we did.
We do not. I mean, I think that needs to be changed. It would probably have to be the Department of Education and not the Department of Higher Education. Senator Roebling?
We just put the higher ed bill out, and there is money in there for the teacher training part of it, for sure.
For this piece?
Yes.
Okay.
It's Senator Pappas's proposal.
Oh, okay.
And she had at least 300,000.
But we would just carry the language, or do you have the language in there?
Mr. Chairman, maybe it'd be appropriate to lay it on the table, but to check with higher ed so that we
work with Senator Pappas.
Coordination.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, that is correct. I think there has been a little confusion with respect to the delivery and the development. And so that's where we're trying to – we went through Senator Pappas' committee, and now we are here because there are two pieces that we need to address. This program will be targeting children from K through 12. But the curriculum and the process of developing, you know, the entire project is in the hands of higher education. So – There is some work that we really need to be doing with both committees in order to address those questions.
Okay. I think what we could do probably is lay this on the table, and then I'll talk to Senator Pappas, or we can get this cleared up.
That would be okay. That's great.
Make the motion.
Yeah. Yes. I think Senator Schoen had a question.
I did, but I think it's been answered.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman, so I would like to present a motion for the committee. And thank you again. I move that Senate file as amended, Senate file 586 as amended, be recommended for possible inclusion in the E-12 education omnibus bill.
Senator Terezre, as we mentioned in the discussion, there's a couple of issues. One is we need to work out with Senator Pappas what the language is that's in the higher education bill. But then also, I think if there is an appropriation from this committee, I think the problem with the year 2007 on line 1.15, 2007 is almost history when we look at we're actually working on FY 08 and
right.
09, so but we do need to clean that up.
Absolutely.
Right. On Senator, and
is it one time money?
Yeah, and I'll work with you and Senator Papp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On Senator Therese Ray's motion on the amendment, the AO7 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Okay. Thank you. And I think Senator Wieger is going to present Senator Saltzman's proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Chairman. So there's a lot of demand. And members, this is Senate File, Senate File 295. Thank you, Senator Wieger, for stepping in for Senator Saltzman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 295 relates to intermediate school districts and would allow member districts to have a safe school levy. To show the need for that, I have testifiers, and they'll have a brief presentation for you to view.
Okay, thank you. And if you could give your name for the record, and we have about 15 minutes. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287, and we are one of three intermediate school districts that ring the metropolitan area and provide services to over 30 suburban school districts. One of the most important services we have is that we provide special education services for students with very significant behavioral disorders.
If someone could maybe turn the lights down so we can see the slides better.
Yes, and I think that was the other resistance to
this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, all of us hear stories in the media about alarming examples of juvenile crime, and I'm here today to raise awareness that juvenile crime and violence doesn't stop when a student gets on a school bus. I'm here to tell you of the violence that we see in the intermediate school districts. Specifically, I'd like to share an example that happened 2 days ago in a district, in a school in my district. We had four middle school boys who truanted from one of our special education buildings for emotionally disturbed students. They ran to a nearby Minnetonka hotel, they stole property, and they culminated the afternoon with carjacking an elderly woman in her car and threatening or physically and verbally abusing her. Middle school boys returned to the school, five squad cars and seven officers dealing with them, along with about a dozen staff people from our educational program. All while this was happening, committee members, we had a 300-pound student at the other end of the building experiencing an acute mental health crisis and was threatening to kill his teacher. We had an ambulance awaiting him and used five staff people to transition the student to the ambulance. The chief of police in Minnetonka told us yesterday he's concerned for the safety of his police officer in our building and is recommending a second police officer. All of this is paid for by Safe Schools money from our member districts. I'm here to tell you about having a student murdered this year. The police come in and investigate other students to determine if they were implicated in the murder. I'm here to tell you about the severity of the mental health issues we see in the students coming in our door. Issues of aggression, sexual predator behavior, psychosis, and severe self-mutilation. And I'm here to tell you as a school leader that I believe a perfect storm is brewing with policy shifts and funding cuts and priorities that seem to have schools in the place that they are the collective social service agency for students. I'm here to tell you that none of us want a tragedy like Red Lake. But I believe as a school leader, I have a responsibility to tell you that I see exactly such a situation unfolding in my school district. My superintendent colleagues and the other two intermediates feel the same way. Last week, we felt so strongly that I met with the Commissioner of Education and the Commissioner of Public Safety to send the same message. I'd like to share with you just a few examples of what's happening in our district. It used to be that schools were places where we educate students. Now we are places for corrections, hospital services, crisis services, outpatient mental health, chemical dependency, and gang and youth diversion. As you know, there's a provision in state law that a mental health provider needs to warn someone when there is a threat on a person's life. In the audience today, we have a supervisor who was threatened by a first-grade student, and we were warned under this provision that a fourth-grade student had made a credible threat to kill him and the teacher in his classroom. The child was returned to school with no transition plan from the hospital. We have another fourth-grade student that has no mental health diagnosis, and yet we see episodes of punching, hitting, kicking, and pushing teachers. We are especially concerned about his sexualized behavior, grabbing of staff breasts, making unnecessary motions towards staff, and always a degree of verbal abuse. I'm here to tell you that we have students that escalate behaviorally and threaten to kill staff on a regular basis, and it always requires multiple staff and police liaison officers to assist them in restraining him. This is an example of a student who was placed in a hospital, then in a crisis home, back to a hospital, another crisis home, and is currently being referred back to my district. A couple weeks ago, we had four eighth-grade male students who, as part of a gang initiation rite, orchestrated a plan to assault younger, vulnerable students at various locations within our middle school building. Students and staff members were injured, and an administrator had his shirt soaked with the student blood by the end of the episode. We recently had two 9th and 10th grade boys physically simulating sodomy in the classroom, and when staff asked them about their actions, they commented that they were practicing for prison. We have a student so angry that she couldn't watch a video that she approached a wheelchair-bound student and proceeded to bite the student on the forehead, taking a chunk of skin off of her head. And then the student, when the staff intervened, continued to rage for literally hours after this incident. These are not unusual incidents, committee members. These happen every day in intermediate school district programs around the metropolitan area. We have a kindergarten student who only attends for 2.5 hours a day due to becoming overwhelmed. And during one incident, he bit the teacher's leg, ripping much of the skin off and leaving a deep bruise the size of a baseball on her leg. We have students who every single day are verbally abusive to staff with language like you see on the screen. This happens every single day. They throw chairs, they knock over items, they pick up objects in the classroom, and they throw them at people. We have a 21-year-old student who needs to be restrained at least once a day. He's nearly 300 pounds, 6 feet tall. He paces, he mutters, he swears in a rageful manner, and he attempts to run through classrooms of little kids. Staff members need to body block him and redirect him, and he lunges, he charges, and he threatens. Literally, staff are picked up off the ground by him, and it always takes 2 to 5 staff people to restrain the student. Just to give you a sense of our program, we have 700 students in our center-based special education programs. Nearly 70% display significant disruptive behavior like I've demonstrated to you. They have profiles such as the characteristics that you see up on this screen. They are severely disturbed young people. In 2003, legislators passed a law requiring districts to notify school personnel when they're expected to provide services to a student with a history of violent behavior. Senators, every single day we bring in students with violent behavior, so much so to comply with this legislative provision. We have an agreement with our teachers union that we will only notify them when even for us, the level of violence exceeds what's our typical student. To date, this year, we are at a rate of 3 times higher notifications to our staff of students coming in with violent behavior. This is an example of a weapon taken away from a sixth grader who was placed in our student program earlier this year. While it is a pellet gun, it's an 18-inch pellet gun, and as you can see, it looks very realistic. We are the site where our member districts send students for weapon violation if they have a special education, individual education plan. In our secondary program that I mentioned when I started my presentation, we have a full-time police officer. In 1 month, you see the kinds of examples of police charges and the type of violence displayed by these young people. Every single day, we have incidents like this. Staff are attacked, and they do their best to come back day in and day out. In a period of time of a little over a year, we had 166 staff injuries. You see them displayed up on this graph under two categories, when they tried to intervene to break up student things and when they were just simply assaulted and attacked by students. In closing, I'd like to conclude by being extraordinarily clear. As a school superintendent who spent their entire career in special education, I truly believe a school tragedy will unfold unless we as leaders recognize two things. Policies have changed, and the schools are taking care of the most severe youth in our communities. We need to acknowledge this and name it and create a new and unique partnership between human services, corrections, and schools. And, Senators, we need to fund policies to ensure that our students and state staff can be safe when they come to school. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is it Ms. Landowski?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. It's pretty astounding to see all that and to see what looks more like a correctional center than a school.
Senator, we do have a corrections program located right in one of our buildings, and the students in the correctional program are less violent than the students who are not in the corrections program.
I was visiting with Mr. Kite a few weeks ago, and he had gone into one of the facilities, and I think he felt that he should have had one or two bodyguards as he went in, because the size of the students and the level of violence was quite dramatic. I guess the question that goes through my mind is that one of the directions that it seems like this committee will take will be a very strong emphasis on trying to fund the special education, basically the cost that districts are cross-subsidizing. And I guess I'm wondering, how would that impact your program? Are you, as an intermediate, absorbing all of the, or pretty much all of the, special education costs for the member districts, or are you just experiencing the kind of that really that group of most severe students?
Mr. Chair and Senators, we provide a range of special education services to our member districts as intermediates, and I certainly would applaud and encourage the full funding of special education within the state. Our tuition bills for the students I just talked about are approximately $40,000 to $60,000 a year billed back to our member districts, and even with that, we feel the extreme pressure from our member districts to contain costs. And with that, I believe the answer to your question, Mr. Chair, would be that while certainly we want our members to get additional funding to fully fund special education, we believe that without the Safe Schools levy dedicated to the intermediates, we are not fully keeping our programs safe.
Let me just follow up. If I guess the question is are the intermediates providing what percent of the total special ed programs are the intermediates providing for the member school districts? And would that money come to you, basically?
Mr. Chair, we provide to approximately 1 to 4% of a member district's special education needs. Okay. They tend to be the most significant involved. And is your question, would the Safe Schools money come directly to us or the full funding money?
I think you pretty much answered my question, is that there's a lot of special education that's being provided in the member districts.
Correct.
And the intermediates are providing special education, but in the cases that you presented to us, a certain amount of that is extremely difficult special education students that you're dealing with. Okay, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what I see here is that the Safe Schools levy for the local districts, they really need that for their local districts. And so it's hard for them to share from that levy to the intermediate districts when you who have a need that in many ways is exceeds what the local district might in fact have, especially at the level of the challenge to personal safety of staff as well as other students and to the students themselves.
Mr. Chair and Senator.
So what you're asking for is allowing those districts to levy an additional amount for Safe Schools, but transmit that to it, rather than giving you the levy authority, transmitting that to the intermediate district.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. There's one other person that I have here. Is it Kay Tessel? Okay. You would like to just share your thoughts. I realize that we'll have session here in just a few minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Kay Kessel, Senator Stumpf and committee members. I have been trying to get a bill for having more money come back to the schools for chemical dependency counselors. And in this bill, the Safe School money goes to the schools, but in Minneapolis, and I retired 4 years ago as an assistant principal, I worked every day with the chemical dependency counselors. Today, there's a half of a chemical dependency counselor at Henry High School, and the rest of the schools have no CD counselors. In this time, and we have the violence in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the gangs and so on, it's a critical piece. And the schools get the money, and I guess I'm just hoping that with this legislation that we would require that the schools use the money for that very thing, for police officers, for chemical dependency counselors, rather than having it go into their budgets where they use it for other purposes. And I just want to say personally, my son went to the Minneapolis schools in junior high. He and a group of friends started using marijuana. And we called the CD counselor at Washburn High School and met with her. All these parents met with her, and then she worked with our kids when they went into the high school. And I think so many of our children would not be where they are today without those intervention services, and we're really missing them. So I also wanted to say I supervise all the special ed programs at South High, and I know there are students of ours that are in prison. I know their names, and because of the violence, and so it's just a critical piece.
It's real. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this legislation? Senator Wieger.
Ms. Chair, I would move that Senate File 295 be laid over and recommended for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Education Bill.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger moves that Senate File 295 be laid on the table for possible consideration in the Omnibus K-12 Education Finance Bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming and sharing that with us. Members, I will be visiting with you, and then I believe the next time we get together as a committee will be next Wednesday.
Oh, we're not meeting tomorrow?
No. So, committee is adjourned.
Thank you.